Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
We found working in a three, actually, now we feel like, God, how could anyone ever be a director on their own? Because especially as being women, I think we were able to support each other. And we kind of discussed this idea of having a tag team.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Balancing Acts. In this conversation, I talk to the co-directors of the documentary Taranga, Sophia Seymour, Daisy Squires and Lou Marilia. Perfect. Hi, this is Steve Whiteley, comedian, actor, filmmaker and writer, all-round ADHD creative. And welcome to my new podcast, Balancing Acts, where I talk to an array of creatives ranging from comedians, actors, directors, all sorts. And we talk about how they find a sense of balance or not between their creative lives and their everyday lives and how that has an impact on their mental health and beyond. Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out. So this chat is a little bit more serious-minded. It's rightly so, because the subject matter deserves it. So I held back from being my usual silly self and had a lovely conversation with the co-directors Sophia, Daisy and Lou of Taranga. It's a documentary film which follows Fata and Yankuba, who are asylum seekers, and they've fled from a dictatorship in Libya and Gambia, and they're now in Naples, and they find themselves in politicized limbo. And they find solace in a migrant-run nightclub called Taranga. So the documentary is beautifully done, and it's very powerful and really humanizes the migrants' struggle, or asylum seekers' struggle upon coming to Europe. So it was such a brilliant documentary, and I'm so pleased I got to talk to them about the process of how the documentary came about, how they all met, because they didn't really know each other prior to working on this project. I think Sophia and Daisy had worked together on one project previously, but they weren't friends before that. So really interesting how they all came about. Sophia's from the UK, but now lives in Naples. Daisy lives in London, and I believe Lou lives in Stockholm. So they come from all over, but they've collaborated. They spent 3 years creating this project, which was produced with The Guardian and distributed online, The Guardian. It was so inspiring to hear how they just fully immersed themselves in this world, and sort of that opened them up to everything that you see in this documentary and also the experiences they had along the way. So it's, as I said, it's different to the usual episodes, but it's a really great chat and I think you're going to enjoy it. So over to Sophia, Daisy and Lou. Perfect. So I am joined now. This is the first time a Balancing Act I've done this. It's going to be quite a balancing act to get this working in an efficient manner, but I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm joined by Sophia, Daisy and Lou, who are the co-directors of Taranga. We all met at, it was Aesthetica, wasn't it? Film Festival last year. And I saw their documentary and it kind of it blew me away, really. You guys made it. It was produced in conjunction with, in association with Guardian, and came out earlier this year. Time, by the way, is blurred for me right now because of lockdown. I have no idea what month or year we are in. So forgive me if my timeline is inaccurate. So over to, you're going to have to decide between, Sophia, I'm going to start with you. Rather than me explain the documentary, do you want to briefly explain the background to the documentary and how it came to be?
So we made Teranga over the course of 3 years. We released it on February the 5th, just before the epidemic struck the world.
Yeah.
And Daisy and I were working on a BBC documentary called Exodus, which was following the lives of the journeys of migrants as they left their homes and arrived in Europe. And Daisy was a producer and I was a local fixer. And we realized there was a kind of gap in the storytelling where the lives of West African migrants who are kind of considered by the media as economic migrants, their story was less of a story that was being told. And we realized that we came across these huge centers in the middle of the countryside where hundreds of young men were living and waiting for their documents and trying to forge a life in this period of limbo where they're kind of citizens from nowhere with no rights and could be waiting for up to 5 years for results on their asylum claim. And within that space, we saw an enormous amount of resistance and joy and strength to kind of get up every morning and attack the world and be with friends and try and stay sane. And we were interested in capturing that moment where you're not sure, we conceptualized it as this waiting room where you're in this waiting room, you're in limbo. What happens in that waiting room and how do the human beings survive?
And before you made this documentary, you guys have collaborated together. And then Lou, how did you come to be a part of this project?
I knew Daisy from a common friend originally, and we were both interested in the same kind of stories. And we had collaborated before on a documentary in Venezuela about young women and how young women were getting sterilized at a very young age, like 20, 21. For life, because they couldn't afford to have children. So we went to Venezuela together. And as we were preparing to go to Venezuela, actually, Daisy and Sophia were talking about making a documentary in Naples and touching upon all of these things that Sophia just said. And we actually couldn't go to Venezuela at that point because it was too dangerous. And so instead, Daisy kind of took me with her to Naples and I met Sophia. And yeah, it was amazing. And like, I think we all kind of clicked immediately. And it really worked out, which was amazing. And it's kind of, we really didn't know when we started that we would embark on this 3 year kind of crazy thing we did, and that we would meet every month and like sleep on Sophia's roof or like sofa literally every month, and that we would make it to do something. It was kind of miraculous that it happened.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like such an adventure that you guys have been on over the last 3 years, you know, to get to this point. And Daisy, prior to this project, and obviously you worked on Exodus before, had you been working on the production side of things, on making documentaries rather than directing? Or would you be doing a bit of both?
Yeah, so my background, I studied social anthropology, and then after university kind of weaved my way into the TV documentary industry, starting out as like a researcher and then slowly making work my way up to a producer, and now from an assistant producer to a producer, and kind of learning each project you go on is totally, totally different. You're working with a new team, a new independent production company on a new project and a new topic. So every time you start a new project, you're kind of starting from scratch. And so you become quite resilient and quite, being able to just start something new and kind of take all your skills and bring them to each project. So working with Lou and Sophia was, we've all come from slightly different backgrounds and made it work, really kind of learning as we went and each bringing our kind of different backgrounds to the project.
Amazing. So that's actually what's going to ask next. Like, how do you go about co-directing a project when there's three of you? How do you decide like who's going to take on what responsibilities, and what do you do when you have a difference of opinion?
Shall I start? So I guess it was a real learning curve, and you know, to this day we're all kind of still learning and, you know, working on how we communicate and how it works and functions. And I think from the get-go we all kind of had total respect for each other and a real kind of want to make it work. And through that kind of collaboration and kind of deep respect for each other, we've kind of really forged our way through it all. And I would say we've had our, you know, a few little ups and downs, but most of the time it was been through making lots of mistakes and coming out the other end and just talking about it and discussing it. And I guess, you know, Lou is really good at editing, which neither Sophia or I can do. Sophia and I have learned how to film a little bit, which has been great. and obviously Sophia speaks Italian, which is great because me and Lou don't, and we're trying to learn Italian. So it's a real kind of pick and mix of skills that we're trying to pull together, but with deep kind of love and respect for each other and like kind of admiration for each other, I guess.
We found working in a three, actually, now we feel like, God, how could anyone ever be a director on their own? Because especially as being women, I think we were able to support each other. And we kind of discussed this idea of having a tag team. So sometimes there'd be two of us working super hard on it and one person would have to check out because of their other jobs or life commitments, and then it would swivel around and then I would duck out and Lou and Daisy would take the reins, and we were able to kind of, that's how we were able to do it for 3 years, because we did this project totally unfinanced, so it was always in between jobs and working out how to kind of fit it in and put in our labor.
Amazing. Because I could see in the credits you guys, it was like a real team effort. You guys have all done a bit of everything. And Lou, am I right in saying you were DOP for this, for the majority of it?
Yeah, I mean, DOP, yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult because we filmed, you know, Sophia was in Naples the whole time, and really the film is based on relationships that she had kind of built prior to the documentary. And because we weren't able to be there at all time, you know, and also like because of this access that she had, she filmed a lot as well with her phone to begin with. And then when we came, like we filmed with Daisy, also filmed, and we all kind of, yeah, it went like around, I guess. But yeah, we all did some filming, and Yankuba and Pata also filmed themselves, which was really helpful.
Yeah, because you have a nice contrast then, like between sort of like their footage, but the footage that you guys shot is beautifully shot. Were you just filming on a DSLR or?
We're filming on an A7S, but also okay. We got help from a friend who's called Max Cutting and who came and filmed at the end as well. It was an FS7, and he also made it look really beautiful. It wouldn't have looked as beautiful without him.
Lou is a badass filmmaker. She's just being really modest.
Okay.
But we also learned it was an amazing time. Like, it's amazing that we did that. We really learned, I think, and maybe one can tell from the footage as well, like from the beginning of the film to the end. We all learned so much constantly, so I think we got better, hopefully, at everything that we were doing. You know, would it be like filming, but even like interviewing, like deciding what the film was about, like everything got better with the years. And I think you can kind of see that in the footage as well.
Yeah,
I was about to say that, that's exactly what I was going to say. What's interesting is like in terms of how this came about, I guess it wouldn't have been possible if Sophia, you hadn't been living in Naples at the time. So do you want to just explain what led you to be living in Naples at that point?
Yeah, so I'd actually studied in Naples a few years before and got the bug, fell in love with the city. Everyone's always like, did you fall in love with a Napoletano? And I always have to say no. So I fell in love with the city and I was determined to come back. And I came back in 2015, which was peak migrant crisis in the news every day. Boats washed up on the shores of Italy, deaths, horrendous news. And, you would be crazy not to be feeling somewhat engaged in that situation living in the south of Italy. So I quickly kind of put out, I remember kind of that being very much at the forefront of my mind when I arrived. And my boyfriend at the time was involved in an Afro-Napoli football team, which was actually doing really well and was getting loads of press. And so I used to be a wag, and I'd go up on the bus and out on the outskirts of the city and go and watch these games where there was just like a full team of West Africans playing all the local kind of hardy suburb teams. And coming back on the bus and everyone's singing reggaeton on the way back and drinking vodka. It was great. And so I got kind of, it had a sort of taster of the community that was the community that thrives and is constant in Naples of various cultures that have come in and are seeking asylum. And through that, I bumped into people in the local square, and not being from Naples and trying to make friends, I suppose, at that time, I found it much easier, actually, honestly, to make friends with a lot of the people, especially from the Gambia, who there seemed to be a kind of affinity and understanding, I guess, of British culture, which is interesting because they were colonized and negative, but at the same time, a mutual understanding of living in, me having grown up in London, and understanding about multicultural places. I don't know. And they felt safer, I guess, not with Italians who they had a kind of distrust with. Anyway, that was kind of how we got involved. And then one of my friends invited me to this nightclub, and it was actually to celebrate Bob Marley. And I was really skeptical. Thought, don't know if I want to go to, I was unsure about what that was going to be like. Anyway, I didn't go. And then when Daisy and Lou came to stay, I said, oh, there's this club that everyone seems to go to. And we ended up going to a Gambian independence party, celebrating independence from the British, which was interesting. And we had an incredible time. All of these men just dancing to their local artist, who was also a migrant living in a camp somewhere, who used to be famous in the Gambia, with lighters, going absolutely bonkers. And we were on this kind of bench, spritz in hand, and kind of saw that the most amazing kind of joy in the room, but sort of also a deep sadness when we realized the trauma that every single person in this room would have gone through to get to Italy and to be in that club, the journey across the desert and across the sea, and life enslaved and captured in Libya, kind of hit us all at the same time. And in many ways, that was kind of the inspiration for the film, to look beyond the surface of things and kind of try and see what was going on behind.
And the two protagonists of the documentary, they're so captivating. How did you guys find them? Was it a case of like pure luck, or was it based on what you were just describing? You meet one person, then you meet somebody else, and they introduce you to... How did that happen? So we're talking about Fata and Yakuba. Daisy, do you want to answer that?
So Fata was a kind of a very close friend of ours, really good friend, so very much in the crew, and he was instantly, you wanted to be his friend. He was like the coolest guy in town, so vibrant, and you just kind of wanted to stick around him. And we kind of slowly got to know Fata, and I kind of, at the end of these club nights, you'd leave, and then you'd realize, you know, we were all heading home to sleep on Sophia's rooftop, and Fata and a lot of his friends were all taking, you know, a 3-hour bus in the middle of the night back to their camp on the top of the hill in, you know, the outskirts of Naples. And over time, Fata slowly kind of, we got to know him, and we went to stay in his camp and saw him kind of, you know, he invited us on when he'd buy bikinis in the summer and, you know, selling umbrellas in the winter, and we kind of got to know him slowly. And Yakuba, we were actually filming with someone else called Nyong at the time, who is actually not in the film, but through him, and he was a cultural mediator working in one of these kind of asylum centers where lots of people live, and he was a cultural mediator, and through him, we were in the car one day filming, and this kid popped his head through the window, and just started chatting to Nyong, the guy we were filming, and he just started rapping and just started singing this song and was just, you know, said hello to us. And then he just walked off, and we were like, wow, who is this kid? He just, you know, had so much, kind of life to him. And so then we got his number, and it turned out he lived in the center which Nyong was working at, and which also a center which we were interested in because of like the corruption that was happening. So through that we slowly got to know Yang Cuba, and as it turned out, like Yang Cuba, you know, had so many passions and was studying in his camp, and was also doing gigs at the weekend, and just had so much. We kept finding out more and more and more about him, and to this day he still, you know, surprises us with the things that he's doing. And it was just quite clear that it was more just, we wanted to hang out with them and find out more. And then through that, that's where kind of the film, why we stuck with Yang Cuba and Fatah. There are so many amazing young people that, you know, could have been in the film.
There was an amazing dynamic that happened very early on for me, pre-filming really, where I met a lot of especially the Gambian community, just hanging out in Piazza Bellini, this local square, and lots of them being like, "You're British, why do you live here?" And me kind of wanting to explain how cool I thought Naples was and how much what a great life they could have here. And then very quickly I was trying to show them how cool Naples is, and then the power dynamics switched as soon as I became close friends, where they were like, "Right, this is where we hang out. These are the clubs that we go to. These are the secret restaurants up on the fourth floor of this building by the station where we're going to have Senegalese." And suddenly we were blown away by their life, and the power dynamics completely shifted, and we were swept up in their world and completely taken over by it. And every day we were filming, we'd kind of be buzzing like around the city, like discovering all these new places. So for us, it was an absolute event, ending up hiding in a room with, you know, they'd laid out biscuits and chocolate, and got, you know, with their €2 a day that they have, they tried to give us the best hospitality possible. I felt like a mum. I would kind of clean the bathroom and stuff.
Yeah, it's really amazing to see, you know, given their circumstances, how optimistic and positive they remained. And following, you know, those two in particular, their journey, I think it was a Fatah who is trying to make it as a DJ, right? And Yakubu, who has got a place at, is it Bangor University? But at the moment, he doesn't have the funds to go and study there. What's amazing about that documentary is just how you humanize them. And I just sort of like, I just want people to, you know, people who are sort of like anti-migrant and come up with the same arguments and we don't want them here and everything. You just watch that documentary and I don't see how you can't be moved not only by their plight but their response and their reaction to their situation. How does it affect you all? Like, you see that, and obviously you're doing what you've done with the documentary, and we'll talk about also what's happened since the documentary and what you've been doing since then to get the message out there. How does it affect you all when you become sort of so immersed in their lives, but there's only so much you can do to help them and their situation?
I think we always, there are a few kind of layers to that. The first thing is because it felt really kind of collaborative with them.
Yeah.
And it was always kind of discussions about what, and as Sophia said, like we constantly learned what the documentary was from being with them, if that makes sense. And it was kind of like Yang Cuba would voice so well, like what happened in Teranga and how we felt kind of taken by, you know, the trauma there, and also the need for joy and the need for like being alive despite it all.
Yeah.
He voiced this so well and explained it so well. And that was kind of, and so it felt like, because they were looking for that joy and because what we wanted to show was that, and it's kind of like this subtle, but we felt really important thing that like, you don't just survive, like you go through all of these things that they were going through, and that was really hard to kind of witness. And then, yeah, we should talk about how we help and like how there is that only as much as we can do, but you see these things. And then we saw them kind of fighting back in a way that was so inspirational, and that kept them and us kind of, you know, motivated, and also made us feel like we could say something that was positive and that showed that, you know, like the really important thing is that even in this situation, they succeed in having fun and kind of like being alive and being, and that's quite, you know, it's a really violent process to have to wait for years in camps where, you know, in corrupted camps, and to not know what's going to happen to you, like, and waiting, this waiting is so violent. And they still find ways to, yeah, kind of just not only survive, but kind of like live and like be alive. And I think that made it, you know, there are a lot of traumatic things that happen in these camps and that happen in their lives, but faced with such like optimism, like their optimism, it felt kind of, it was easier, you know, it felt like we could only kind of be optimistic with them and show that part of their lives. And then also, I think, but then you guys can also talk about that, but we, yeah, there's only as much as you can do, and they still had to go back to their camps in the evenings where, when we didn't,
yeah. You know,
and that's a massive thing. And I think we've tried to make choices as kind of, we decided early on that we would make decisions as like human beings first and then like kind of filmmakers second. And sometimes that was tough decisions when we kind of, you know, when they would, we didn't leave them in situations that were horrible sometimes, even though like filming it might have meant more for the country, just because we felt like that wasn't a priority then, you know? And I think, and that was constant discussions amongst them, ourselves and with them, about what to do in these situations. And I think when you film vulnerable people or people in vulnerable situations, that's something you kind of have to ask yourself all the time. Perfect.
Hello, sorry to interrupt in the middle of this insightful conversation, which I'm enjoying, I'm sure, just as much as you are. But I need to give you guys a little reminder. If you like this conversation, this episode, if you like Balancing Acts in general, then please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it makes the world of difference. And the more reviews we get, the more rates we get, the more people can discover the podcast and we can make it go viral, whatever that means. Okay, back to the chat.
Also, importantly, not capitalizing on trauma, on Black trauma.
Yeah.
And that's really, really, really important. And something that I think has come out of the Black Lives Matter movement as well, on how to tell stories which aren't just white journalists taking advantage of a certain situation. And it's not something that we felt that we had a full grasp of, but by constantly asking ourselves the questions and keeping us all collaborating together with the contributors and in our work and including them in our workflow, we were very, you know, we wanted to tell the story how we lived it, and the way that we lived it was hanging out with them, going to Taranga, hanging out in camps, playing football, going down to the sea, whatever these things were that we were doing with them. We wanted the audience to kind of hang out with them as we experienced hanging out with them, rather than trying to weave in another narrative to sell a film about migration. That was kind of the strong impulse.
Right. I mean, because they were like round at your apartment, weren't they? You were sort of like partying together, just having fun. Like you said, you just became friends. And then I think that's what allowed it to have such an intimate feel. Like they, you can see that they clearly trusted you.
Yeah. Well, they were around my house every weekend, cooking Gambian food.
Which looked delicious, by the way. I wanted to ask, I was like, had food envy watching that. I was like, yeah. Can you please like delve into what the Gambian food consists of?
Oh, it's so delicious. We put on about 12 kilos over the space of filming, but, so there's domoda, which is banging because it's just peanut butter and chicken.
Oh, okay.
Peanut butter, and they make this really delicious short rice. So it's really light, and it gets burnt at the top of the bottom of the pan, and that's kind of the prize bit. You get this like burnty, crispy rice at the bottom.
Okay.
And then there's also just sauce, which is just chicken and potatoes and tomatoes, and in a kind of soupy kind of casserole that you have with rice as well. And they're super good. There's this amazing Senegalese señora who has the secret restaurant in Naples, which we always go to, in her flat. Okay. And you can go up at any time of day, and she's feeding everyone who can't afford to eat, and wow, those that can pay and those that can't. And you kind of, over the time, given her donations and things, but she's when you come, we'll go for Senegalese
in Yasser.
Yeah.
Say that again, Daisy.
Chiara, the woman who runs the Senegalese restaurant, has an amazing yassa dish, which I highly recommend.
Okay, fantastic.
In answer to your question, just about kind of the process of making a film and then just not abandoning the contributors, I think that we were really, really aware of that. And, you know, me opening up my flat and things doesn't just stop at the end of the film. That was happening before and will continue to happen. And through lockdown, we are really aware that many, many, many migrants living in the south of Italy were without contracts and without support. And so we're not heroes by the best of days, but we did a fan base to try and raise money to distribute food parcels every week during COVID, just to kind of, on behalf of Taranga, kind of trying to give back a little bit as well, as best as we could.
Itself, the club, were almost shut down, and so we also tried to help support Taranga keep going as well.
What's amazing about Taranga as well is that most of, correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the guys that go there are Muslims, so then they're having this amazing time. They're not drinking any alcohol, and it sort of has a very sort of like, I don't know, just like nourishing feel to it. They're just there enjoying the music. It's not like over here where everyone's doing shots. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, it's there's a real mixture of people who go to Taranga. There's like a big proportion are Muslims and don't drink or smoke, but just go there to dance and have a good time, hang out with their mates, like in a really safe space. And there's also a kind of Neapolitan contingent who kind of has a lot of really cool Neapolitan dancers who, again, who just go to dance and these kind of troops of incredible dancers who we were all standing on the sidelines, very envious of everyone's moves, kind of bopping in the corner.
Did you join in?
I think we would have made it embarrass ourselves if we joined in, but we looked in admiration. It's just a really safe space for kind of everyone of all ages, and I guess that's why it makes it and feel so special, is that everyone's welcome, and kind of people go there for completely different wants and needs, but find a kind of safe space.
And Lou, how did The Guardian come on board to produce the project? Because I know you said at the beginning, you found your way as you went along with this, so there wasn't a sort of a clear plan from the beginning. So at what stage did they come on board?
I think after a year and a half, 2 years of filming, we approached them with the project and they were interested. And then the way it worked is like, we were kind of almost, it was 2 years probably. We were almost done with filming, but kept on going for a few months here and there and started editing. So we did the edit at The Guardian and kind of, but you know, from, you know, early on, we knew that we wanted it to be about this will to kind of live despite everything and want to show that, but we weren't sure how. And also we wanted to touch upon the corruption that exists in reception centers in Naples, specifically in Italy, that receive money from the European Union, and like basically each center gets 30 to 35 euros a day per migrant to give them essentials, sort of like hot water, food, social services, all these kind of things. And often migrants don't receive these services, and instead the money is pocketed by corrupted, migrant reception center owners.
Are those centers run, or are they sort of, are they run in collaboration with mafia? Is that how it works?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're often privately run. Mafia is kind of, they're run by criminals, and there has been kind of mafia owners that have been on trial for it. And yes, that is. So we wanted to show that because we could see it like with our own eyes when we were visiting, different people. And that was kind of like the beginning. And then we got to know, so Fatah and Yankuba, got to know their personal stories, learned about Taranga, and it became more kind of targeted about the club and the role that club played, because we felt like that was a way, as Sophia said, to kind of not not only show like kind of like the misery, but also show the fight back through music and through dancing and all of that. So yeah, The Guardian came on board after we had kind of found this angle, and we edited with them, published it on their website, and then we did a longer version for the BBC, iAfrica, later this year.
Awesome. It's cool that you just sort of, you went into this almost sort of just like blindfolded, and you've just, you know, you've come out with this amazing project, and now it's sort of taken a life of its own, hasn't it, really, since it's come out. Do you want to talk to me, Sophia, do you want to talk about what's happened since it's been released and the kind of things that you've been doing in terms of giving talks and so forth?
Yeah, so it's definitely had a life of its own, which is, we're really, really pleased and honoured that it's having such an impact. I think for all of us initially, yes, we wanted to make a film for our own joy and interest, but fundamentally we wanted people to experience these people as we experience them as some kind of activism towards changing perceptions around migrants, and especially West African migrants, who are often discredited, and their lives are often just kind of not considered valuable, and so in the way that it's reported in the press. And so when we first started, lots of journalists in Italy especially were just like, there's no chance in hell that anyone in Italy is going to promote this documentary or write about it. So when it came out and we were interviewed in kind of every major newspaper in Italy, there wasn't a pride that the documentary was being talked about. There was a pride in that talking about the documentary, they were talking positively about the situation, and for that we were incredibly proud and honoured. And then after that, we've had lovely, submitted to festivals and had premieres and Q&As and lots of the kind of standard things. But a couple of the things that stood out for us are, the first was that we found out that in a school in Seville, a teacher had been using the documentary to teach their 12-year-old kids about immigration, and had put together a Q&A that they had to do for a comprehension that they had to do for their homework, which we were absolutely so thrilled. Cool. And like, for us, that made it. And then there was another really beautiful thing that we found out, that the Senegalese community had organized a screening on their own behalf after a football game. They showed the football game and then they showed Teranga, and were so proud to kind of own it and call it their own. So for us, that felt like a huge privilege. Otherwise all the normal things like press and festivals has been really, really great, but those for us have been the most important moments.
Brilliant. And Daisy, what can people who watch Teranga and feel like they want to do something to help, what would you advise, or where would you point them to if they want to help in any kind of way?
Yeah, it's such a good question and such a hard one to answer, and I guess there's a few things. So firstly, it's like, I guess what the aim of the documentary is to kind of humanise the issues at hand. And the way that we kind of did that was through making friends and kind of real genuine connections with people, where you get to learn and properly understand someone else's life. So I think that's kind of number one, is like, really, when next time when you kind of are on your beach holiday in South Italy and you see someone selling, I don't know, black, you know, bikinis on the beach, like, that could be fatter.
Exactly,
you know, just try and kind of humanize and take the time to get to know people and your neighbors, and you know, so that's number one. I guess number two, like, Yankuba, as the documentary kind of ends, Yankuba has had applied for university in Bangor, and since then he's decided that he can't afford to go to university in the UK anymore because he would be charged international fees, making it totally unaffordable. So he's decided to kind of change tack, and he's applied, and he's taking his exam this week, actually. No, 2 days ago he took his entrance exams for medical school in Italy, which we're like insanely proud of. And we've set up a crowdfunder, which we set up after the release of the film. And now we're trying our very best to keep the money coming in so he can afford his university fees in Italy to study medicine. And we hope that to be able to support him through the crowdfunder over the next 5 years if he gets in. So we would encourage
people. Can people find that?
He's in an exam as we speak, by the way.
Okay.
He was sleeping on my sofa last night. And he has to do the IMAT, which is like the most crazy test. It's verbal reasoning and logic and maths and general knowledge. And he's very, nice. Very confident.
Wow, okay.
So the crowdfunder on our website, which is tarangadocumentary.com, I think. We'll share it with you so you can share it far and wide.
Add it into the show notes as well.
Amazing. And I guess other than that, there's like so many great NGOs and like, you know, charities, help refugees, who do amazing things like across Europe and the world. But I think for us, it's the most valuable thing has really been kind of on a personal level, getting to know someone and kind of helping an individual where you can.
Yeah, what an amazing thing to do. And now you've obviously had this incredible experience together, and you've, like you said, you almost prefer working as a team than individually. Have you got any projects lined up? Have you got something lined up next?
We do. We've just recently set up a production company.
Great.
Called Isosceles Productions. And Lunsfire, should we talk about things we've got, we hope to do?
Yeah, we've realized that, you know, it's got to be migration, it's got to be Italy. we're looking at a coming of age story about a young boy that Daisy was on a rescue boat with when he was pulled out of the sea from a dinghy in 2015, and we're hoping to trace his life until he is 20. Now he'll be coming to be 17, but we're not sure yet. That's all in the early stages, depending on funding and access. But yeah, we really hope to work together in the future and use this model of collaborative filmmaking as a way to encourage other women as well to work together, especially when you get into your 30s and with childcare and things, that hopefully it's more of a sustainable way of working.
Yeah, I think like from the moment I met you guys, I just thought it was so cool, the whole story about how you'd all just collaborated, and at certain points just being in different countries and working on this project together and, you know, putting out something really good into the world. And at the same time, it seems like having, you know, an amazing time, obviously hard at times, but having an amazing time doing it as well. So where can people find out more from you guys? I'll go on, Sophia, have I missed something?
Yeah, I just wanted to, the girls are going to laugh because I always do a little promotion, but the music was also...
The music was amazing.
The music is so, so good. And that is made by asylum seekers in Naples, who have a DIY studio behind the station. And they released an EP. None of them have their documents yet, but they released an EP alongside the documentary in January. And that is called... they are called Dozer Starlet. No, they're called Dozer Gang. Sorry, they changed their name in January, Dozer Gang. And you can find that EP on YouTube. It's free. And we are still looking. The plan is, we promoted them a lot on the radio, and I'm sure if you wanted to weave in some songs into this podcast, you can. But we kind of got them into NTS and various radio stations in January, and we're trying to get them a record deal. So if anyone's listening,
I might be able to put you in touch with someone. We'll have a talk after. I know a man who knows a man.
Right. Goes back to our music industry days, Steve.
Exactly. Okay, guys. Well, thank you for your time. It's been great chatting to you. And actually, wasn't that chaotic? I think we've managed to do this in very orderly and mannered fashion. So well
done.
That's how
we work. Three of us.
can be your little tagline. We work in orderly fashion. Instagrams, people, is that something you want to do? Where can people follow you all individually? Lou?
Individually at Lou Maridier, MARIIIR. But the documentary is at Teranga Documentary. right? And also at Isosceles Productions for new production house, Isosceles Production, yeah. Right?
Lots of films coming to you soon.
Yes.
And Fatah is, he would love you to follow him.
Yes.
He is, he's going to be famous. He wants to be famous. He is Fatah Lifestyle TV on Instagram.
Okay.
And he has all sorts of brilliant videos of him working out in the gym and DJing and making mixtapes.
Great. Okay. Well, be sure to check him out. And finally, where can people watch the documentary?
On the Guardian website.
Okay.
Not sure where you find.
Say that again, sorry, Daisy.
So a longer version, which came out on BBC Africa Eye, but we're not entirely sure how you find it. But if you're lucky enough to find it, it's out there.
Okay.
If you're watching national TV in Ghana, it might be on there.
Okay.
Apparently, that's all they told us.
Fine. And Sophia and Daisy, do you want to, is there anywhere anyone can follow you guys individually?
At Daisy Squires.
Okay.
At Sophia Seymour.
Okay, I will also add all of that into the show notes. All right, well, I think we covered stuff, didn't we?
Yeah.
I think so.
Good chat. Look, yeah.
It's been great.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Like I said, I thought it was such a brilliant documentary, everything about it. And yeah, very moving, but also funny. There's some really funny moments, like the bit when they're watching the Spider-Man video crawling up to save the baby. I won't give it away, but it's made me lol. All right, guys, well, look, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We have it, episode 40, would you believe, in the can, or also known as episode 10 series 5. Just depends how you look at it. Either way, it's a milestone. It is a milestone because I did not think I would be recording 40 episodes. No. You know, I wanted to record these. I came up with this idea. I've mentioned this before because I was very curious to how creatives go about doing their thing. And during this whole process of creating whatever it is that they are creating, how they find a balance or not with their mental health. I mean, I don't need to tell you all this. You know this. I mean, it even says it in the intro. So I'm just really wasting your time and my time. The point is, it's a very monumental moment, which I've just completely and utterly ruined. So let's all give a round of applause for that. Fantastic. So if you like this episode, please do rate and review the podcast on Apple and subscribe if you haven't done already. There's going to be lots more great conversations coming up soon. I might start expanding the conversation and start including some of my inner circle. I want to mix it up between having some, you know, more serious minded conversations like such as today, and you know, that's sort of deserved to be, you know, talked about in such a manner, with more silly conversations. So I might get this a guy called Steve Number Two, who's he's kind of like my brother-in-law but not, and we have very, very silly conversations whilst surfing or cycling or rock climbing, sometimes all three together at the same time. So I've been meaning to invite Steve onto the podcast because I think you really need to hear him. I mean, this sort of rubbish that comes out of his mouth, it's enjoyable to listen to. He's a barrel of laughs. So Steve Number Two might be coming on the podcast soon, as might some other of my amigos. And together we will chat shit. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. And thank you as always for listening. And see you later. Balancing Acts is made in association with The Comedy Crowd, who support independent comedy creators. They showcase the best new videos on comedycrowdtv.com and across media platforms. They support independent comedy creators and showcase the best new videos, including adult animation, sketch shows, web series, viral hits, and lots more. So if you're a creator, then do check them out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.